handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman, see you at over.
Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, see you at out.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie, 435-921. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie, 473-989, out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds HEBT. TOT 53.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. We're so pleased that you stayed with us on the Denise Simon Experience. Robert Bortons hasn't been with us for a while, but he carved out some time to join us. He is the CEO of Classical Conversations, which actually supports Christian homeschoolers and across our country and several foreign countries as well. So we're actually going to have a discussion here about the syllabus and what is happening in not only the public school systems, but certainly in with the homeschool syllabus. So, Robert, thanks for the good work you continue to do, and welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Watching pretty closely here because we're in Florida, and Florida also is kind of leading the way in several other states, including Georgia, some of these governors are pushing their legislatures to work to change up the syllabus, which I think is a good thing. I don't know what these teachers' unions are thinking about it, but it seems that some of these missions by educations and educators and legislators are beginning to see that they need to make up for an awful lot of damage. And it's going to take a long while, but not only do they need to know about civics and history, but they need to know about financial literacy too. And I think something is happening out there in Washington State, correct?
Yeah, I mean, more and more states are starting to see that the woke curriculum isn't working and trying to figure out what to do next and really looking at the skills students need to be successful long term. But, you know, it's going to be very difficult if it's still, you know, 30 kids in a classroom with one adult trying to teach them, and just inherent flaws with our government school system that we see the fruit of all over the place.
I would say in order to have some financial literacy, you got to have some math literacy. Is it kind of a backdoor that you sort of teach math by using money?
Well, yeah, you've got to have some math. Yes, you definitely have to have a strong math background to understand finances. And you know, just looking at our government officials, it's pretty clear with the deficits they run and the things they fund and the value we get for our tax dollars. They don't really get it. So just as a homeschool person, I'm pretty skeptical that these individuals who aren't able to live these things out in their own lives are going to be able to pass these ideals onto our next generation in mass in a great way. But yeah, I mean, students are, you know, more intrigued with money. And of course, you know, even with my own kids, I have three younger kids and we use games with money and, you know, different things, simulating like being a cash register and stuff like that to try to get them interested and reinforcing these ideas. I mean, but we also do things like memorizing multiplication tables and the squares and cubes and, you know, math formulas, because you're not going to be able to have fun with something if you don't know the basics of it. I mean, imagine trying to play basketball without knowing the basics of dribbling, passing, and shooting. And that's really the problem in our government school systems, is they've neglected the basics and said, oh, they don't need the basics. They've got calculators, and the calculators can do them for them. Like, if you're practicing math isn't fun, so let's do all these other things. So until we get back to, you know, teaching grammar and the grammar of math, which is the multiplication tables and addition tables, until we really start back to having a classical education, our school systems are doomed. And there are more and more legislators looking at going back to the classics and trying to figure out how to integrate that into the government school system. That will be a balm to some of the pain that students see and feel. I know in like North Carolina, where I live, they're trying to bring back phonics, but they're not calling it phonics because they don't want to have to, you know, admit that they were wrong for 20 years, and whole reading is a terrible way to teach reading, and that's why we have significantly higher illiteracy rates than before the Civil War, than during the you know, War for Independence. We saw, you know, literacy rates were extremely high in the United States, and now less than one third of our students can read at grade level. You know, one of the things that they always were talking about with like Donald Trump was he would talk at a sixth grade level. Well, that's about where the average American is. So that's why he talks at that level. And they actually, you know, are trying to get our politicians to dumb down their talking because people can't understand it if they talk at an eighth grade level in our state country anymore. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I applaud legislators for seeing that the fruit of our public school systems is rotten, and that, you know, in many cases it's almost abusive to send kids to some of these schools. And they're trying to figure out what's right, but we know what's right. It's what's worked for 3,000 years, and that's classical education. And so we need a full stop on what we've been doing, but it starts in the teachers' colleges, and the teachers' colleges are still, you know, full bore woke. They're still teaching critical race theory, critical gender theory. And so legislators really need to look at their local university systems that they're funding with taxpayers' dollars. And if they're teaching, you know, feminist studies to our teachers instead of teaching them how to pass on knowledge to the next generation, they need to defund those programs.
I have a 38-year-old who was always on a roll, interestingly enough. And I found out about 10 years ago he never understood percentages. He did fractions, but he couldn't do percentages. And I kind of tilted my head and said, "How's that possible? Because they're really the same thing." You see ads and say, "Oh, it's 30% off." You know, dude, how do you did you ever try and calculate that? No, I just knew that it was going to be cheaper. Then I have a 44-year-old who, a couple of years ago, got himself an interesting job. And after about the first week, he came home and he said, "I never learned how to read a tape measure,"
Wow.
which is into certainly into very minute fractions.
Sure.
And now, and interestingly enough, today, he's actually so good at all of those things and woodworking and tape measures and whatnot, he actually is. You know, one of their top trainers. So, you don't know what's going to happen to you later in life. And I would say you absolutely need the very basics. And it seems like the left, Robert, has actually said we don't like the standards anymore. And they've lowered standards in just about every facet of our lives, whether they break the law, they lower the standard by which some may be arrested or charged. They're certainly lowering it in the college boards, whether you have to even take the LSAT to get into law school or not. I mean, it's really just everywhere. If you lower the standards, then you get what you deserve, correct?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Children naturally rise to high standards that are set in front of them, and they're trying to I mean, their goal is a population that will listen to the experts. And I think anyone who listened to the experts last 4 years understands that that's a bad consequence for all of us. And they want a centralized government that controls all of our lives. And so you need a populace that is not well educated to make that happen. And so just by lowering the standards really just makes it so that you know, students are passing. They think they're smart. They think that they're you know, going to be able to achieve so many things once they get out, and then they come to find out that the real world and economics isn't as soft as what it was made out to be. And so you know, My wife was a public school teacher for 10 years, and she saw just how every year it was getting dumber and dumber down. They wouldn't let her teach her subjects the way she knew to teach them. She was forced to teach them ways that didn't work, and she knew that they didn't work. And if she tried to give them extra homework or help them really understand what they were learning, she'd get her hand slapped by the administration. And so, people say, "Well, there's good teachers in my schools." It's like, yeah, but the system itself is corrupt. Like my wife saw nearly 300 students every single day. So, I mean, you can't. It's hard enough. I got three kids to love three kids well that are my flesh and blood on a daily basis, much less 300 kids that aren't your own. And so, yeah, it's just the system itself is so corrupt that a lot of these things could be a temporary balm on the issue, but lowering our standards was the wrong way to go. The No Child Left Behind just means everyone got passed. Similar to your story that you were sharing, my mom shares a story of talking to a parent. His daughter was getting straight A's in math at a good school, at a good public school, and she went to work for Chick-fil-A and was a cash register one day, and she came home after her first day at Chick-fil-A crying. And she said, Dad, how we made fun of people who, kind of don't know how to do math when they work or do make change. I didn't know how to make change today." And her dad was flabbergasted because, she's at a good school, quote unquote, right? And she's getting straight A's in all of her math. So how could she not make basic change? And so, I mean, the teachers, I mean, quite frankly, because they're overwhelmed, if you show up and you smile and you're obedient, you get an A. Because they're just trying to help those that are so far behind, try to stay with the class. And so it's not designed for our best students. It's not designed for our worst students, and everyone else, everyone's getting, it's not No Child Left Behind, it's Every Child Left Behind. And it's really they changed the name of it. I don't know what the latest edition is, but the underlying, ideas about childhood and what the system should do to them is not changing. They just like to change the sign on the front door so you think it's under new management.
I think kids in school, regardless of what grade, they like to compete. They like to see if they can rise, they like the challenge. They like to rise to the
For
occasion.
sure.
And you necessarily know that because if you have your kids home on a weekend on a rainy night and nobody has anything to do, what do? You pull out the board games or you pull out a deck of cards and all of a sudden people want to compete. They want to win at Gin Rummy or Canasta or Monopoly or and so it tells you that they can be critical thinkers, but you got to give them the material to rise to that, correct?
Well, absolutely. Kids, really do excel. The amount of information that we see our homeschooling kids learning on a daily basis is phenomenal. And these kids aren't any different than any other kids. They're not, super geniuses. They don't have super high IQs. We're just giving them the materials that we know kids their age can handle, and we're giving it to them in a way that they can process it. And so, our students memorize the times tables up to 15. They memorize over 200 history facts. They memorize the quadratic equation when they're in kindergarten. They don't know what to do with it, but the problem with our math curriculum in the United States is when they're trying to memorize the quadratic equation in high school, they don't know how to do multiplication tables. And so not only are they getting A's and B's and C's thrown into their math equation, and they don't even know how to multiply 2 times 3 equals 6. And so we really have a it's been an you've seen the curriculum in government systems go to an experiential curriculum. 2 plus 2 equals 4, how does that make you feel? And kids don't have that type of wisdom or experience. And you can just go back and look at the entrance exams to high schools and colleges, 60, 100 years ago, to see that we've gone from, expecting kids to learn Latin to remedial English and remedial math in our colleges. The number of students now that are going to college that have to start in remedial is amazing. And it's remedial math, I think, in high school, I mean, in college, is like ninth grade. It's not like they're redoing 12th grade math. I mean, they are significantly behind, is part of the reason why college takes 5-6 years to graduate now, and people have $2 trillion plus in debt, is because they didn't learn what they needed to learn in the first K-12. And so the important thing for people, for your listeners to realize, is this is being done on purpose. Like, the government school system isn't failing our kids. It's actually it's wildly outperforming the founders' wildest dreams. They knew they couldn't take over America with an educated populace who loves freedom. And so by forcing kids to be in school for 12, 13, 14, 15 years, forced to sit down and shut up and do what they're told, they know that they can mold these people, they can groom them into good little socialists who will vote for a large centralized government to take care of all their needs, because the system that that government funded that was supposed to educate them isn't able to educate them. And it doesn't educate them on purpose, because then that will destroy their goal of a large centralized government. And a free people would never accept the government that we have. And so we can just look at our federal debt of $34 trillion to know that a free people would never elect these people to continue to represent them.
I would argue if you're educated, if even if you, you know, you may not be good at English, but you're very good at history, or if you're not very good at history, you're good at science or math. And that gives the students some self-reliance. They know that they've got a skill set that will take them someplace. And then, you know, when they have become very good at that, then they can build on other skill sets. So, you know, if you're self-reliant, then you don't need government. And you become a critical thinker, and you can depend upon yourself to fall back on some skills and that you're very good at, and build the others. So I think that kind of, you know, I subscribe to a phone app called Nextdoor, and
right.
I look at these posts that people put on Nextdoor, and these are adults that are in there. And, you know, Robert, they can ask the dumbest questions. I mean, so stupid. And it's the same way on Facebook, but, you know.
Sure.
Next door, these people are supposed to kind of like be your neighbors. And then the way that they spell, the way they construct a sentence, you can tell we're in trouble. And these are adults. So we're not only did we cheat these adults, but we're cheating their children. And we can't compete on a global stage, can we?
No, we can't compete on a global stage. Not much longer. We have some inherent advantages with our geography, and we do have a strong base of wealth that can keep us going for a little longer. But the warning signs are flashing all over the place. The American empire, much like the Roman Empire, much like all the empires before us, is gotten fat and has gotten greedy and has gotten really rejected the things that got us where we are today. And it's not sustainable anymore. And, you know, God can be gracious to us and still pull us out of it. But, you know, I think it's going to take a national repentance at this point for us to see our better days ahead of us. That doesn't mean I'm not fighting for it. Obviously, we're trying to get more and more people homeschooling and a classical education. And, you know, there's definitely bright lights that could really rescue us. And maybe things get so dark, you know, things are getting so dark, even, you know, people who are left of center are starting to pull their kids out of public schools because they see how much garbage the far left is throwing down their kids' throats. And so when normal parents are seeing that the system is breaking apart and isn't able to really service their needs, that does give me some hope that people will not be woke, but will wake up and realize that this path that we're on is unsustainable. But there's so many, I mean, the amount of laws we have on the books, the systems that have been put in place to keep the average person servile to, you know, big government and big business, you know, requires, you know, really a gumption and a backbone by our legislators to fight back and give us our freedom back. And until we get our freedom back, it's going to be difficult. But a free people must demand it from their elected officials and not just sit by idly in between election years.
Well, they're throwing their destiny at people they don't know. But if you, Robert, if you took a homeschooled sixth grader and a public schooled sixth grader and put them side by side and asked them questions written on paper, you would get very different answers, wouldn't you? I mean, just to put two of them together and to measure their depth of knowledge at the sixth grade would be, what would that look like to you?
Yeah, I mean, just picking like an average one that's kind of in, I mean, the average, sixth grade homeschool student is probably going to be familiar with Latin or Greek, is going to probably have an intimate knowledge of our founding documents and a basic understanding of what's in the Bill of Rights, what's in the Constitution, how these are different from each other. Your average sixth grader in the public school system probably can't spell Bill of Rights.
When my younger one was a freshman in college, after he finished his first quarter, I asked him, I said, what was your best class, you know, in college? And he said, Introduction to Law. He had no idea of the variety, how much law is out there and what you can and cannot do and motivations and evidence and all those other kinds of things. And it really kind of told me, too, that we probably ought to look at the syllabus and do some introduction into law as well, in addition to civics. And there was a time, too, Robert, that, you know, we taught home economics and for the girls, and the boys were doing shop mechanical. They always work on a car, or they would do woodworking. And those are things that, you know, I mean, kids today, they, if you ask them to go check the oil and see what the oil level is in your car, they don't even know what the dipstick is, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's they've tried to suck the fun out of learning, and they know that children naturally want to learn, that they're natural learners, they're sponges, and so they have to kill the love of learning from children.
Brilliant.
And they do that in the public school system, and that's why private or really homeschoolers flourish the most out of any of the systems with the least amount of cost, because parents want their kids to enjoy learning. And you know, the average American, I think it's like 80% of Americans don't read a book after they finish high school, or if they go to college, don't read another book after they finish college. So we can see that our systems have sucked the love of learning from our kids, versus homeschoolers are, you know, reading books after books all the time for the rest of their lives. And so mm-hmm. that's how you gain more knowledge and experience outside of doing things yourself, because you can only be in one place at one time. And so you need to learn from the best and brightest minds that have been out there. And so, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, taking those things away make us, reliant on, other people to survive. They, destroy our self-reliance. And, learning those things help us become, adults that are functioning and able to take care of ourselves instead of relying on the government for welfare to take care of ourselves. And of course we wouldn't want that. And so of course these things are getting removed. And so, I mean, you can have, the best of intentions and legislation and, move these things to a beneficial direction. But again, the teachers' colleges are still not going to be embracing these things unless they're forced to. And you still have a system that's not designed around educating children. It's designed around babysitting them. I mean, there's no, as Ronald Reagan said, if a foreign country came in and instituted our public school systems on us, we would consider it an act of war. And,
well
that was
said.
40 years ago, and so nothing.
Robert Borton, thanks for this conversation. I don't think that anybody can necessarily disagree with this discussion, but it certainly gives people something to think about. So thanks so much for staying in the fight and sharing some time with us. Well done. And ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way in the Denise Simon Experience. Stay with us.
Hey, Dad, your prescription will be ready in just a minute. Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad, your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can, making sure they're safe and comfortable. But it's just as important that you take some time for yourself. At AARP, we can help with information and useful tips on how you can maintain a healthy life balance, care for your own physical and mental well-being, and manage the challenges of caring for a loved one. Because the better care you take of yourself, the better care you can provide for your loved one.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. You're there for them. We're here for you. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're so pleased that you stayed with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. Andrew Boston has been kind enough to rejoin us. It's been a little while, but Andrew is an expert on a lot of things, especially when it comes to jihadism and where we are with this Jew hatred movement that is not just here in the United States, but it's really become a global thing. And he's going to help us shed some more light on this. And Andrew, we're so pleased that you've been in the fight all these years, but you carved out some time to be with us. So welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Denise.
When we talk about this red-green thing, help us with that. Describe it so the listeners can begin to understand what this really is about.
Well, I think it literally goes back to, so first of all, when we say red, we're talking about, you know, Marxist communist, and green would be Islamic. And I think it goes back literally to Marx himself. And Marx was a virulent Jew hater, it's interesting because his father was Jewish, converted to Christianity, and Marx was raised baptized but became an atheist. So, you know, the idea, you know, how could Marx be anti-Semitic? Well, he created his own religion and calls it, communism, Marxism. Mm-hmm. But he was just, you know, you read his writings, he was an annihilationist. He wanted the emancipation of society from Jewry by basically getting rid of Jews. It sounds like you're reading Mein Kampf when you go back and read something like The Jewish Question, which he wrote in 1843. So he was a virulent anti-Semite, not only in theory, but, you know, Jews sort of disgusted him. He says the Jews of Poland are the smeariest of all races.
Mm-hmm.
He just had a visceral hatred of Jews, both in terms of the as a group and as individuals. But when it came to championing, being basically the original proponent of the so-called Red-Green Alliance, it was really for his aims of sowing, fomenting revolution in general. So he talked about being able to defeat Tsarist Russia and create revolution by an alliance with the tottering Ottoman Empire. He said in a letter in 1878, the defeat of the Russians would greatly accelerate the social upheaval in Russia, the elements for which are plentiful, and thereby the reversal in all of Europe. So it's a practical, not that he had any affinity for Islam. He hated all religions,
But he saw certainly the jihadism of the Ottomans as a means of fomenting his revolution to topple the Western governments. So I would say that's really the practical origins of this. We see some evidence. I gave another example in an essay or just a blog I put up recently. There was a whole series of pogroms against the Jews of historical Palestine, fomented by the leader that would become the leader of the Palestinian Muslim movement, Hashemin al-Husseini. This took place in 1929. It spread out from Hebron to a number of towns and cities in historical Palestine. There was a lot of atrocities and carnage. It didn't look that much different in reality. It was smaller scale than October 7th of late, that just took place several months ago. Very brutal massacres of Jews. You can see the communist movement siding with the Arabs. And publishing these hideous cartoons. They look like the Nazi cartoons that would come, be common, within a decade later. Very Der Stürmer-like cartoons that were published, including in communist publication in Yiddish in New York City. And then you see in this magnificent autobiography that Whitaker Chambers wrote about his apostasy basically from the communist movement as an American in Witness. Chambers was editing a communist newspaper called the Daily Worker, and he writes about this in Witness, talking about this same period, around the 1929 pogroms in Hebron in Palestine. He says, "Arab outrages were occurring in Palestine. The Communist International chose that moment to call for the formation of a, quote, Soviet Arabistan and to attack the Zionists. Day after day, bludgeoning stories and editorials along this mad line appeared in the Daily Worker," which he was then the editor of. He says, "Editing them seemed less like a peculiarly trying exercise in party discipline than horseplay in a mental home." So now he's reflecting back on just how crazy this was. But, then he was a movement communist, in 1929. And he was editing these screeds against the Jews.
Andrew, is Europe in a worse indoctrination in all of this than the United States?
I used to think so, but it's getting pretty bad here too. I think the Muslim part of the equation is much worse in Europe. They have larger, certainly population. On a percentage populations in Europe. I would admit that I think they're more militant than the Muslim populations in the United States, but our population is getting more militant too. I mean, I think October 7th brought some of that out. When you see 58% of the Muslims in the United States believing that the attacks on October 7th were justified, that's a frightening figure. And I don't think it's going to get better. I think it's going to get worse. But certainly, the overall situation between both the left and the Muslims is worse in Europe.
I think it is too. I think, however, what scares me is there's a lot of things that are bad in Europe. And they end up being here months later, or I wouldn't even say years later. It's really more like months later. Is that right?
Oh no, it's happening. It's accelerated. Yeah, it's accelerated over the last 20 years. The differences are narrowing, it's happening at all levels too. It's not, it was 50 years ago that a very respected and pretty honest scholar of Islam, Maxime Rodin-San, who had been a communist and left the movement. He wrote 50 years ago that he was very concerned about what the post-colonial left was doing to Islamic studies and changing it in such a way, as he said, and this is teaching at the university level, he said, understanding has given way to apologetics, pure and simple, when it came to Islam. And so this has been going on. Again, he's writing this in 1974, and it was already in place. So we've had you know, more than half a century of this type of teaching at the university level. And then I remember being asked about 15 years ago now to look at high school curricula and textbooks, and particularly the Regents, the New York State Regents exam. So the New York State Regents exam are these merit-based exams that give students scholarships to college, particularly to state universities in New York. And it was really what got my wife and I started on our trajectories, which ultimately, you know, led to going to medical school and becoming physicians. And so when I saw an educator sent me the materials, the grading guidelines for the history Regents, and what the students were expected to regurgitate, it was so disturbing, because it was this demonization of Christianity and the period of the colonization, particularly of the Americas, by European explorers. It was cast in the darkest light, and then everything about Islam was completely bowdlerized, and the kids had to regurgitate these conceptions to get the best grades. So, you know, it was they had completely, as far as I was concerned, they had completely abrogated their responsibility to teach objective history, and they were forcing kids to repeat these distortions in order to get the best grades and potentially even get money for scholarships. It was just awful. It was just absolutely awful. But what I'm saying is that I think by the time the kids get to college, they've already been, you know, those that are susceptible to it, they've already been indoctrinated.
Planted,
you know. Yeah, yeah.
let's go back several years to when we had the mass migration of Syrian refugees, mm-hmm. which ended up not being only Syrian refugees. They were Islamic refugees from several countries that pretty much destroyed Greece and then Italy and then went to all throughout Europe. And then you ended up with all of these no-go zones, and you had the European Union with their court system, which, by the way, it's one court system. They were giving all of these generous sentences, if they were sentenced at all, to these Islamists that were, breaking the law. So it was forcing normal citizens to accept all things Islam, whether it was in Paris. Remember all the attacks in Paris and in Belgium. Right.
And Germany. A terrible in Cologne. There was a horrible rape that were committed on New Year's Eve. And yeah, it's been a process that's been slow and steady, and then you get these outbreaks of violence and mayhem, and I think the same thing in the UK, and a lot of it all, the massive demonstrations and the threat became more apparent in the wake of October 7th. When you saw, you know, almost perversely, I would say, you know, this horrific attack. You know, I mean, I don't like all these Holocaust analogies, but on this occasion, this horrible occasion, actually was the largest death toll of single day death toll of Jews since the Holocaust. And then you see shortly after that. I mean, I'm talking about even before the major Israeli retaliation. You saw these demonstrations. Celebrating these attacks throughout Europe and in the United States too, and driven you know, yes, the left participated, but they're still basically Muslim-driven demonstrations, and certainly all the menacing, the threats of violence and the violence that was committed is by the Muslims. It's not by the people with, you know, 12 different colored hair and 16 different genders or whatever. It's the Muslims.
And so therein lies where the next question comes, is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, Andrew, is to me, is that we have this violence in Islam. Not only are we seeing it in the West Bank, certainly in Gaza, but we just described all of these places in Europe where they had it. And then we have these protests here and so forth and so on. And so where are these leaders? Where is the kingdom of Saudi Arabia or the king of Jordan? They're not having the discussions with these factions, you know, with Islamic State.
No, I mean, look.
It's shaming their religion.
I was very pleased with the practical nature of something like the Abraham Accords.
Right.
Or the even cold pieces with between Israel and Jordan, between Israel and Egypt. But you're absolutely right. The fact remains that these, you know, so-called moderate Arab regimes, when push comes to shove, and maybe there is some sincere desire amongst the leadership to have peace, you know, even if they're not particularly fond of Jews or the Israeli government, but just to have peace. But you know, it doesn't extend to actually engaging in the kinds of religious and civic reforms that would alter their societies. I that to me is nonsense. The facades that they put out about reform, they're not changing what's taught, and it's not just about Jews. They're not changing the hate that's right. taught about all non-Muslims in their societies. They really aren't doing anything about that. Egypt does have a Christian population, the Copts, but they're still very much persecuted and dehumanized in so many
Same
ways.
Same thing with Lebanon.
Lebanon is now majority Muslim, and the Christians are under siege and have to toe the line or they suffer, you know, consequences. And then, you know, most of the Arab Muslim world is devoid of Christians, let alone Jews, you know? So, yeah, I don't think that we're seeing a movement within Islam to a mea culpa based movement to acknowledge the ugly legacy of what these teachings have wrought, of what the Islamic conquests were really all about, and how they've led to the chronic grinding oppression and then dissolution of these minority populations, so that you're basically creating monolithic Muslim cultures in these societies with you know, some of these residual populations that are still under siege. There's no mea culpa based acknowledgement of any of this or changing the theology. You know, Denise, the day of the attacks, Al-Azhar University, the day of the October 7th mm-hmm. attacks, Al-Azhar University, which is the Vatican of Sunni Islam, issued statements mentioning nothing about the atrocities Hamas had committed. And those were obvious pretty quickly. Or even the aggression itself, all they talked about was the, quote, heroic Palestinian resistance. The heroic resistance, you know, massacres mm-hmm. have just taken mm-hmm. place. Within less than 2 weeks, Al-Azhar, from that, so by October 19th, Al-Azhar actually issued a fatwa, a religious edict, stating that the lives of all Israelis were legitimate targets of jihad. That's a heinous kind of fatwa to issue, but what's equally disgusting and despicable is the fact that there's no comment about this from Western nations,
right,
including our own country, condemning that type of religious incitement And by the way, Denise, this never happens. The most hideous proclamations come out of Al-Azhar University on the Sunni side, you know, prestigious religious teaching institutions from Shiite Islam, all the time. And they pass the response is silence or just ignoring them. I think, you know, so what's the incentive to change? You know, there isn't any. And what's getting concerning is that, you know, the Middle East Media Research Institute, which has been monitoring Arab and Muslim media, particularly, you know, in the mm-hmm. Middle East and in Muslim countries, has since 9/11 also studied materials and sermons in the United States. And they've been very assiduous in their monitoring since October 7th here in the U.S. And by the way, this is not done surreptitiously. They go to the websites. The sermons are posted. Materials are posted.
Yeah,
they read them. They listen to them. They watch them. Yeah. So yeah, they're not sending, you know, Muslim speaking people to go in and infiltrate. It's public. So what they've reported after looking at hundreds of sermons is that they cannot, in the United States, they cannot find a single sermon that condemned the atrocities of Hamas. However, they've provided dozens of examples of just virulently anti-Semitic materials that are regurgitated from the Quran, from the traditions of Muhammad, you know, and contextualized in a modern way. So being used to teach and incite now. One of the worst ones I saw was again, this was within 2 weeks of the massacre on October 7th, was Muslim kids in a Colorado mosque being taught one of these very, very negative stereotypical themes in the Quran about how the Jews were transformed into apes or apes and pigs for allegedly disobeying the Sabbath, you know, and you know, it's a legend. But it's from the Quran, and it's been used to incite violence against Jews across the centuries. This was being taught to basically, it looked to be like, I watched the whole video, it looked to be like 10-year-old kids,
mm-hmm.
and a whole other litany.
I saw it.
A whole other litany of negative, you know, Quranic stereotypes about Jews. And this was being taught now, and how these kids should view Jews now. Again, there's no condemnation. You know, right. I heard Biden the other day got all up in arms because actually it was Memory did a report published as a Wall Street Journal op-ed about what's been going on for 20 years in Dearborn, Michigan, Dearborn, Michigan. And Biden is you know, belching forth his commentary about Islamophobia. And all the op-ed was pointing out is there's been jihadist activity, there's been anti-Semitic and hateful sermons preached in Dearborn, and that, you know, the government should pay attention to this, you know, and so right away, you know, all you get out of certain politicians is that this is Islamophobic.
Well, and we used to have here something called the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go
Now it's targeting white supremacists because, you know,
yes.
That's the big problem. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so,
well,
it's not a settled issue, obviously, in Europe, but now here in the United States, it's become a real problem, you know, with these protests and these attacks and so forth that we're having.
Oh, they're disruptive. They're very disruptive to airports, to highways. You know, it's ridiculous what's being tolerated, and it's only going to whet the appetite for more if it's not you know, quickly dispersed and disbanded, and these people arrested for you know, disturbing the peace, for shutting down the ability of people to get to and from work or wherever the heck they want to go. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's like the George Floyd riots that were allowed to go on.
Precisely. And so where do we lay blame? And I don't think that there's one place. Obviously, Iran's been a problem going back 40 years to the Jimmy Carter administration. So,
I think the blame is on us.
Well, there's the United Nations, and there's Qatar. Yeah, and well, yes, and the State Department. Yes,
but I mean, why are we in the United Nations? I mean, if we want to do some humanitarian, if we want to engage in some humanitarian activities, we can do it independent of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. They don't serve any purpose other than to promote the interests of communist countries and the Muslim bloc. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's just be honest about it. That's all mm-hmm. they're doing. And frankly, you know, that's the way it's been since the beginning. the creation of the UN is very interesting in terms of the communist movement. And in mm-hmm. terms of infiltration in the FDR and Truman administrations, but be that as it may, it clearly doesn't serve any function, any purpose for the United States to be a part of it. And it's the same thing with regard to our policies, particularly well now under the Trump was starting to engage in some real politics, but yes. The idea that we're sending assets, quote unquote, frozen assets back to Iran and allowing them to sell oil unencumbered and our policies are crazy and self-defeating, almost by design, one might say.
And then it's costing us safety. We're losing, yes. Peace of mind here. But bigger than that, yes. it's costing us money. I mean,
the biggest insanity, of course, and now people are finally paying some attention to it, are the open borders that we have.
Yes.
And the flow in of jihadists, of communists, of narco terrorists. It's suicidal.
Well, it is, and there was a time that we talked about the Muslim Brotherhood an awful lot, and we're not talking about it anymore. CARE is kind of Council of American Islamic Relations. That's kind of coming back into the headlines here a little bit, but I would argue
the Council of Angry Islamic Radicals.
There you go.
All joking aside, they're literally an offshoot of Hamas. They come from the same tree. They're a branch off the same tree, the Islamic Association of Palestine. I mean, they're just a political wing of Hamas. So what do you expect them to do? I mean, it's like, I don't know what the surprise is. The only thing that's surprising is that they're accepted as a quote-unquote Muslim civil rights organization. They're a jihadist organization.
Well, and they're forcing tolerance on us, just like they did in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
So this is fair warning. And I think that's really the discussion you and I are having here that necessarily began with the red and green Axis alliance, yes?
Yeah. A lot of these streams come together. the phony multiculturalism of communism, Marxism, and then seeking common cause with the jihadists, and then of course whoever achieves its aims first will destroy the other. I mean, that's exactly what happened during the Khomeini revolution. I mean, he was allied with the communists. The Shiite Muslims were much more numerous and powerful. But they did ally with the communists to help get rid of the Shah, and then he slaughtered the communists, Khomeini, when he achieved his goals.
Andrew Bostrom, thanks for this conversation. I think you helped put things in historical context and in current day context, not only here in the United States, but globally. But, I guess here at this point, we're worried about our own safety. And so thanks for having this discussion. We appreciate your time. Well done. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure having you along with the ride. We'll see you again very soon.
The Conversation Starter. This is Talk 92.1 WDDQ 8L Valdosta.